6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Well, you're a tech, huh?
Yeah, I'm a history professor at tech. Mm-hmm. I'm doing this study, as my letter indicated, of race relations of 20th century Latin. Mm-hmm. Interviewing a lot of people. I just told your wife that I had interviewed L.D. Milton last summer. So I've just been right on this block. Yeah.
Get a chance to catch him before he went on to the great beyond.
Well, he was not feeling well even when I had seen him. Mm-hmm. But had a good memory and
it's quite old.
Yeah, certainly was. Well, let me
I've got a lot of research here.
Took me a bit around all the time.
Yeah.
Knew what was going on.
Okay.
Let me start by looking at your role as regional director of the EEOC.
Right.
And I was curious first about what sort of problems you faced in opening up jobs to the black community.
Well, of course, perhaps for a moment of background, when I started, there weren't any offices in the field. EEOC had only been in existence for a relatively short time. The office that I opened here was in the region. And the Dallas office opened the same week, and those were the first two offices that opened in the country. And that was on the heels of the civil rights struggle. Still very much part of it, really. And so many of the problems that have been indicated at the section prior to that time were still very much in vogue. Sort of resistance to even the idea. In some cases, it wasn't even safe for our investigators. Indeed, we another who was locked up in the building.
In Atlanta?
No, this is in Florida. The other place in South Carolina. I remember going down the road in North Carolina with Nigel Pastor in the car, driving the semi-trailer. I'd slap us off the road. So it wasn't easy to see.
How about in Atlanta itself?
Well, in Atlanta itself, I recall that there was a great amount of difficulty trying to just get the group sponsor the meeting of Plans for Progress, which was in just trying to get the group together to sponsor the meeting of Plans for Progress, which was very difficult.
Plans for Progress was the effort to...
Yes, Plans for Progress was a group that had been... it was federal, and they sought to get with business people and to work through them in trying to foster the idea of open power, you know, and the like.
So there were problems in Atlanta getting the business people together on that.
Oh, yes. So there was a considerable resistance. We didn't have any kind of physical or effort to produce that experience in certain places. But there was a considerable resistance to the idea of equal opportunity. Born.
I guess this sort of goes against this so-called spirit of compromise and communication that was supposed to exist in America.
Yes, and really that was about all planned progress was, you see.
Yeah.
It was not a part of the activity of government which did investigating of that kind of thing, such as we were seeing. And to get them to have a little meeting for EEOC or virtually, you know, they just could not get the group together for that purpose of the
white company.
Of the white power structure, the kind of thing that you would expect, you know, chamber people, chamber people, the kind of people that that wasn't, they weren't ready for that quite yet. But it was not long before there began to be an effort in those directions. But there wasn't much enthusiasm about it. The National Alliance for Business began to try to function, which was some of the more forward-thinking business people in the downtown area.
Mm-hmm. How cooperative was the city government trying to open up job opportunities? Ivan Allen was supposed to be a friend. From what I heard from other people.
Well, at that time we didn't have jurisdiction over government agencies, you see, and that made some difference. So we didn't have jurisdiction over government agencies in much earlier days, and I remember early on meeting with Ivan and whoever, a group that wanted to be a part of the movement to get jobs or have jobs under NAB. As I recollect it, see, we're talking about 20 years ago now, but to have them exempt from Title VII, what I'm saying is that, as I recollect NAB at that time, they, they were to take in a certain number of people and at a certain price and try to get them started in different kinds of jobs and carry them along and but they didn't want to have them to they themselves did not want to have to function under Title VII, particularly as it related to that program. And I remember some discussion I had with them in that regard. I didn't know enough about their program at the time to make a judgment or even to know whether this was an effort at trying to have some anomaly in the process of their own total workings so as to give only lip service, or whether it was truly a genuine situation at that time.
But there was resistance nonetheless, I guess.
But there was some resistance nevertheless to complete accession to the rigors of Title VII, I would say. I think it's fair to say that. I have to sort of reach for that because that goes back. I remember we had some problem getting the newspaper for an entrance to conform to the idea of not listing advertisements by sex or religion, you know, so we had to really come down on that. And to get them to accede to the idea of using the phrase that if the paper was an equal opportunity employer, they weren't ready for that. I remember that the deal was, but the big boys weren't the top of the country. They weren't ready for that. A little avant-garde. That's a little out in front of where the people are.
How about problems related to, in terms of opening up jobs, related to residential concentration in the city, or the city transportation network? Was it because of the way the city was set up racially and personally, but the way the city transportation network was set up, was it difficult opening up jobs at all in relation to that?
Well, we found in many instances that employers who had jobs that were available, and many employers generally resisted the idea of the federal government trying to tell them what to do in the operation of their business as related to the employment of people. The matter of employment, of transportation, posed some problems where there were new employers or new industries developing on the outskirts and the like. It was not our function to get out and try to do too much in the way of opening up jobs per se. In the normal run, but we did have a voluntary programs set up and a technical assistance set up which was not well staffed in the early days because we just didn't have that many people or have that much money, to expand that kind of an operation. We did, when we would go to an employer, be trying to work out a conciliation agreement, we might indicate to an employer who would be a respondent in case that there was a feeling that they needed to have this many blacks or this many women over a period of time, try to set up some kind of goals and timetables for them at certain percentages. And they would say, well, we can't find them. And they'd say, well, that's your problem. They're out there. And however, we would always try to be helpful where we could and suggest places where they may be able to get people and sources where they might be able to get people, if not get them, help them get them. For instance, we might refer them to me, to the NAACP. We might require them to put notices in papers that were in black newspapers and other papers that were of more general distribution where blacks might see them, use the churches, those kinds of things. We did that all the time. We never had any real problem with Martha because I don't remember the problem ever coming up directly to us. There were times when the matter of how workers would be able to get to places were which made it difficult for them. The problem would surface, but we did not have staff enough to try to work out those kinds of problems. We felt that it would be incumbent upon us to leave those to the people who were not.
Did Martha ever interested in expanding the transportation network to get people to the jobs at all?
I don't remember it coming up directly. I don't remember it coming up directly. It may be that some of the companies themselves sought to get MARTA to make some, have some feeders or some extensions, etc. But I don't remember the problem coming to us directly.
Did you ever find any situation in which there were reprisals, economic reprisals against blacks who were involved or active in the separation movement? Did you deal with that?
We had innumerable cases in which there would be charging parties alleging that there had been retaliation against them, even for filing a charge or for encouraging someone else to file a charge or talking with a group that was sort of disenchanted. That was not an uncommon kind of situation. Which was the reason for Section 704 of the Act, which made retaliation, harassment, and that kind of thing, a violation of the law itself. So that would be even a separate charge. You may have a charge for based on the lack of promotion or based on the old classification, which was illegal, or some other form of situation. But then you may also have a separate charge which would deal with the matter of retaliation.
Well, let me get on to something else. You were, I know, involved in the desegregation cases at the airport in 57 and the bus desegregation case in 59. And I was curious what your feelings were about the position of the city government in these two cases, particularly in Foxfield's supportive, not anything.
Well, in the bus case of 59, there was some cooperation with Jenkins, who was at that time the chief of police, and of course I'm sure that they had the blessing of the mayor in the working out of that situation, warning that they were to get arrested and to make the case. So I think it's fair to say that there was no real resistance to that situation. Make his behind the cast and everything. It was also, the situation was different in 57 in Cope versus the city of Atlanta. Cope receiver from Birmingham, which was a charge man, he was the life insurance company, and he had gone to segregated situation out there, dealing with the Dobbs house, and perhaps something else. And that's how that case arose. And well, it went through all the normal channels. And I think that Greenberg was going to try that case. I don't know specifically what you might want to. But there was a different kind of, well, I think there was no cooperation in the process of the handling of that case as there had been in the process of the handling of the bus case.
Did you get the feeling, sir, that the white officials were going to do as little as possible to force to by law? So pretty much.
Oh yeah, that was always the case. And of course it was different when it came to public accommodations that were like that as against the ones of restaurants or that kind of thing where it was quite bitter because you had private entrepreneurs who were involved, and even the situation involving Fulton County courthouse restaurant and the city hall restaurant, there was resistance right down to yeah.
Resistance from the mayor's office?
Well, the extent to which the mayor's office was involved, I don't know. I think that perhaps the mayor felt pretty much like most of the downtown folk felt. Let me retract that again. The mayor didn't want to be out there by himself. And so he would try to lead in such a way as to, how would I express that, do what he could without seemingly acceding, at least ostensibly, you know. There was backroom talk from time to time, but it was sort of like I have an Alan Sid reference to Parks. After we had had the case of that involved the parks and certain other facilities, you would say we desegregated the parks, etc., voluntarily pursuant to a court order. So they always wanted to have the court order to lean on, regardless of what their personal attitude was. They wanted to have that fulcrum, and then even if they had that, they would go and say, you see, we've got to do this, and they get behind it or run and get in front of it and carry on.
I was also curious about Ivan Allen and the civil rights protesters, sit-in groups and stuff. I was curious about the reaction of the city officials to the mass arrests that took place in the early 60s. Was Allen a friend in regard to that? You tried a lot of those cases.
Yeah, we tried a lot of those cases. You see, you had some hostility among certain of the judges, but most especially Pye.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some hostility among some of the city judges.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't in the slightest sympathetic, and they were afraid not to, to show themselves as the knights of perfection for the system. So they showed themselves to be quite resistant. There was no evidence, by and large, of any unusual restraint, or maybe I should put it the other way. There was a lot less difficulty here than in a lot of other places. I'm sure that the reason for that is that there was an administration that did not want the city to have the same kind of living that was the situation, the operations that were attaching in other places to different forms.
You want to come out of Birmingham?
That's right. But at the same time, police and others were out there, they were out there to do their job, and some did it with more vengeance than others, because some of them had a really negative attitude. Not only that, you needed their jobs and become
what that situation
was. And I suppose there was also a degree of that they could never tell what things that I was doing. And so I would not suggest that the jobs of those who were the forces in those kinds of situations were easy. But they did not have a lot of budgeting and that kind of perspective. Somebody may get lost on the occasion, but the people reacting to the approach that is based upon the reactions that made the so-called leaders have a kind of conduct that would not have been true but for the situation at the moment.
So Allen and Jenkins try to keep a lid on
there's no question about that. There's no question about that.
Do you think in terms of how the black students were treated by the courts, was an effort made by Rice to treat them as a failing and this upper repercussions on the justice system afterwards? Because I always understood that before all this happened, for a black man to go before a white judge to be charged with a crime, it would be just about getting his sentence already beyond the having a fair trial. But this change after the mass arrest was more of an effort to make the justice system more equitable, at least in Atlanta.
I would go so far as to say that I think it made many of those in the judicial hierarchy more sensitive to the problems and affected black people. But I think that would be about as far as I could go in it. See, there are many cases that never did ever come up. There were some that didn't come up because, I'm sure because they didn't want them to come up. I'm sure there were others that didn't come up. Only because the calendars and so forth were very delicate out of power, the courts could get down for a matter of weeks at a time.
But how about afterwards? Let's say after civil rights, this letter is black men brought before a court on a crime, not a civil rights crime. Would there be any chance of getting fair treatment as a result of judges becoming a little more sensitive to that black problem or situation back then?
I'm sure that I go back to my former statement of, and I will justify it this way. Keep in mind that all of this activity and the many pieces that were applied where the issues were raised made for many, many, many jury lists getting more blacks on the jury list, and as a result, getting into the petty jury panels, and that itself made for considerable difference. Time and time again, as we went to some of these cases in different places where we would have to raise the jury exclusion situation, especially outside of... outside of the metropolitan area, say if we got out to, mostly out to Atlanta, so we have had to raise the Columbus and Albany and then Macon and then many of these other areas where they had it had just been disregarded. They were reviewed in Atlanta also. The issue has got, had been raised here, and they had revised their jury list here, and they had a separate jury clerk who was a very, very fair and open-minded person, and Mrs. Witcher, whom I knew very well. And ultimately, you had Dr. Wakefield, whom you would know as a history person, but he was on the jury commission, and these things were, the inertia of them made for a gradual change in things.
So the civil rights protest did lead to opening up.
Oh yes, there were
journalists.
Sure, that inertia had a scattering effect, not just the cases themselves, but as things happened, and as there were cases that were favorable throughout the South and sometimes in other sections of the country, that would have an effect, and then you had judges in state courts having to conform as the federal courts would hand down decisions and ultimately say that Supreme Court, which would be the law of the land, and it became less and less of a position for the state courts to stand out there alone, resisting what had been clearly declared to be the law of the nation.
It's really a combination of the civil rights protests and the federal government's intervention.
All of that had had effect.
So there's no doubt that a black person born before a jury or a judge in 1958 would be treated much differently than he would be in 1968 in terms of what happened in the intervention.
That's I don't know how much difference, but I would say there would be certainly a sensitivity to the circumstance in a way that might inure to its benefit. I think that would be the way that I would want to express it, rather than to make the declaration that there would be a lot of difference, because that would depend on what the case was, who the judge was. There are just too many things that would be involved to make that kind of a federal statement.
Also curious, the election of Maynard Jackson in 73, did this mean any kind of change for the Maynards? have in regard to higher and black? Would there be, would you see a perceptive difference once a black is in there at all?
Well, some had met greater resistance, but I would like to think that his insistence on it being a part of city government had the effect of further sensitizing people, entrepreneurs, to the effect that this is the thing to be done. And then there is even another thing, in my opinion, which is as well, and that is, as this took place, I'd like to think that some of the entrepreneurs themselves began to really believe that this is the thing to do as it relates to women, as it relates to blacks, etc. That as they began to see an expansion of the workforce potential and not only that, it happened to stay out of trouble. And so I think all of these things working together had some effect.
So Mayor Jackson bringing blacks into city government more than any other mayor had done, joint venture programs, things like that, that all helped too?
All of that helped. That helped set the tone. All of that. And I don't think there's any question.
I was also curious about any ability to get the unions to open up a little bit. Did you do that at all?
Yes. Keep in mind that unions were also listed among those types of organizations that were alluded to as a part of Title VII itself. And so there was some expansion among unions and some tightening up. It worked both ways, as far as I'm concerned. So one thing was that where we had the large internationals very frequently, we tried to work with the headquarters and would generally always notify them where there was, because they wanted to be notified. And whereas we might serve the particular local, the fact is we would also serve the property owner of the national. They tried to police their own house. And in many instances, they ran into resistance even within their own house. There were many problems with union, many problems, many cases against union. At the same time, there were many brought by unions where charges would be made and the union would be aligned with the EOC in the trial of cases against a respondent, the company respondent.
They really vary. Resistance to some.
That's very true. Very true. Sometimes you would get the unions, that's like the communication workers, you see. You may be working in situations where we would be on the same side as they would be on, vice versa, trying to get breakthroughs consistent with what we said was bold, particularly in trying to resolve cases. We would be able to get a lot of information from you, and but of course we always did our own thing, but they were there, they knew what was going on, they were the workers, and you can understand that being able to work with them and wanting to have knowledge and cooperation and information like could be very helpful in what you want. But you couldn't, we would have to serve them, let's say the charge was brought to us, well, we would have to serve the union, even though the union may not be brought in because it's a necessary part. Depending on its attitude, sometimes it might be that they, if you got into court on occasion, it might get aligned by the court with the defendant. But more often than not, it was the other way around, because you just couldn't settle the case without union, because you need plants and the like.
You better need any real sense of the spirit of the cooperation or moderation here was, I know it wasn't Birmingham, but was there sort of a feeling that Atlanta was, not the city to be, the hate of the city of somewhat moderation in terms of race relations?
I think that perhaps it might well be stated, as I think you did in the latter statement, which was it was a city of greater moderation than what you had in a lot of other cities. Brought on by any number of things. One, it's a regional center, and that brings in people from many areas of the country. It also brings in, I would say, more than the ordinary place might bring in, a level of persons, a level of person that she knows it.
I guess I was curious whether the leadership here, the white leadership, was any more enlightened at all.
I was going to get to that. One of the reasons is that the black leadership was more enlightened than what you would find in most places.
That's part of the policy system.
And that's a product of colleges and businesses and the like, and even though the socialization was extraordinarily extraordinarily limited, other than on a work basis prior to it's not that broad even now, prior to say the mid-60s, the fact remains that the influence of the university setting can't really be measured, but it definitely has an influence because it permeates the almost any structure that you can think of. And of course, in the last 15, 20 years, where there's been a greater political participation, again, it's back in the leadership situation. Those kinds of things had their effect. There were always a few blacks that talked with a few of the whites who were sort of big news, so to speak, and it would be wherever close growth, no one wanted to be exposed. Whites didn't want to be exposed to whites, and blacks didn't really want to be exposed to blacks very frequently because of the onus that could fall upon you, and your loss of whatever leadership, be it titular or otherwise, that you possess. But there was always some talking. But I remember, say, in 56, for instance, and I didn't come here until, like in the last part of 51. I had a residence here long before that, but I didn't come here. Standard school, things were very, very, oh, I remember, we had the Great Books program, and like telling people that others who were, what you would call, liberals at that time, you were it wasn't please down and we met in the university's church, and we met Harry Boyd, the director of the Red Cross, and we met and his conference. So that was a way out thing. Ultimately, when the new Jewish Community Center came in by the next year, and things were very tight. And those who were the news were very conservative.
So the moderation really is tempered enough, isn't it? Not, I guess...
Nothing universal.
And the only thing unique here was that there were some whites going to meet with some blacks someplace, which you didn't find in a lot of other cities.
That's the point. True.
Yeah. That part of it is. Did Martin Luther King Jr. ever sense this at all? Did he feel Atlanta was similar to other cities in terms of racism? Did he feel Atlanta was more moderate? Did you get a sense of that?
Personally, I don't know that we ever discussed it in that manner. I think that our attitudes about it, like especially in 60, when we came in 60, the feeling was that we could expect the same kind of resistance that was being exhibited in other places in the South where it started. That we resisted by the police and resisted by all of the white establishment authorities. At the same time, I think that there was always the feeling that there would probably not be the kind of latent cruelty that one might have in Alabama, Mississippi, that kind of thing. Matter of fact, that the blacks would probably not stand for it, and that the whites in this city had some reason to understand that they would not stand for that kind of group. Well, I guess they would rise up in a very indignant physical way if it ever got to them. That's what they really did not want.
So they didn't want to hurt the image of the city.
No, actually.
Whereas Hawksfield and Allen, who are depending somewhat on black votes, that's what they consideration.
That's right. And that was, we didn't mention that, that was a factor. This city back in those days, the black was the swing vote, especially in the city proper.
So Atlanta was really unique in some ways.
That's true.
I mean, Herbert Jenkins wasn't full planet.
Not all, by no stretch of the imagination. By no stretch.
Well, that's about what I wanted to ask. It's all very interesting.
It is very interesting.
It's
it was an interesting period.